Welcome. Today we're talking about the 30th anniversary of Injured Workers Day, which is coming up on June 1st, 2013, a couple days in the future here. And we're going to be looking at an industry that's close to home that has a lot to do with injured worker activism at the moment, also tied to migrant rights and unionization, struggles for unionization as well in the province of Ontario. I have with me Lalo from Fuerza Puerza, which is a local migrant rights group. So welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
First question is, maybe you could give us a bit of a background on the kind of work that you do as an individual and also with Fuerza Puerza.
Sure. Yeah. So I work with Fuerza Puerza based here in Guelph, and we work as allies to folks coming under temporary foreign worker programs. And most of our work has been with folks working in farming or within the agricultural industry, a lot of them coming under the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, which is the oldest and the biggest migrant farm worker program. A lot of other people are coming under the LSPP program that started in 2002. And so we basically have connected to folks in different communities in the region of Niagara, Bradford, Ontario, Simcoe, Ontario, as well as Leamington. So we travel to communities where the majority of folks are arriving, and our work has been focused on various issues that folks have identified as important to them and issues that they are looking for support around. So through our works lately, or as of late, maybe the last 2 years, we've been focusing more and more around health and safety issues and wellness issues, as obviously agriculture work is very strenuous and it's some of the most dangerous work. So a lot of people's concerns are kind of raising around those issues. So we've been kind of focusing a bit on trying to educate ourselves about the industry and health and safety.
Cool. Can you maybe talk a bit about the kind of regulation and enforcement that's in place right now to protect agricultural workers?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm not an expert, but through our work, we're trying to kind of become more knowledgeable. But what we've really been finding is that basically the agricultural industry actually wasn't under the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which is kind of the act that regulates health and safety in various industries. Oftentimes, historically, agriculture was seen as kind of like a family business that didn't really employ wage workers, right? It was often seen as like a family enterprise. So for the longest time, kind of government regulation on standards and safety, things like that, didn't really mobilize onto the industry. But in 2006, it finally came under the Health and Safety Act. But what we're finding is that agriculture continues to really be pretty under regulated, basically. And the few regulations that are in place, there's a lot of actual issues that really make the on-the-ground rights that people have actually not really work or become kind of obsolete and not useful for folks. But in terms of the regulation, what we're seeing is that there's pretty limited clear regulation in terms of people's rights and the standards on the workplace. A lot of them have to do with employers, for example, having a responsibility to ensure that they're doing the utmost to keep workers safe, something around like due diligence, that they're looking at hazards and identifying hazards at the workplace. There's different regulations around workers having the right to refuse work, the right to participate in identifying these hazards and kind of working to with the employers to really address their concerns, things like that. Employers also have the responsibility to maintain, machinery up to date and things like that. But in terms of real standards around, for example, whether folks should have shade when they're working outside in the sun, or who should be paying for personal protective equipment when they're working around different kind of hazards or things like that, that's left very unclear. And so that's really problematic, because the enforcement component of the or the enforcement, which is the Ministry of Labor around kind of occupational health and safety, then they don't really have a lot to work with in terms of really trying to regulate farms, basically. And another thing that really becomes problematic is that the regulation is very much reactionary, and it really depends on people coming forward and posing complaints. So if they have kind of concerns around at their workplace, you know, whether they feel like some of the work they're doing is unsafe, or they're not sure about something, or if they outright see something that they know is you know, putting them in danger or a risk, the system waits for them or depends on them for them to come forward and basically file a complaint with the Ministry of Labor. And so here's where kind of a lot of things become even more problematic, because the Ministry of Labor's complaint system is basically based on a phone call, like a phone-based kind of complaint system, or an online complaint system. It's not proactive in terms of, you know, the ministry kind of going out there and you know, doing inspections and things like that. It's very much just by phone or by internet. So specifically with the folks that we're working in, that becomes very problematic. Obviously, access to computers and computer literacy issues are not computer literacy isn't super widespread, and access to a computer, even amongst people that do have knowledge and how to navigate the internet, access at the farm is not really available. And also in terms of language adequacy, both the system online as well as the phone call-in kind of system are both only available in English and French. So it really systematically makes it inaccessible to folks who don't speak those languages. And under these temporary foreign worker programs, we're seeing a lot of people coming from Mexico, Guatemala, Thailand, and folks who do not speak English or French, right? So just in terms of regulations, it leaves a lot of people really without a lot of regulation or a lot of support in terms of actual enforcing the rights that they do have.
Okay, so you've talked a bit about how difficult even accessing the reporting system is, but why is it that seasonal agricultural workers would be even less likely to raise their voices in the first place, even if those venues were accessible to them? You know, if they had their languages, if they knew the number, if they could get on the website quickly?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that connects to how the system is not really made for what you could identify as vulnerable workers, right? Even, you know, folks with status that might be affected by, you know, poverty. Obviously, folks working as migrant farm workers are also affected by precarious status and poverty that really push people to fear reprisals, fear coming forward, speaking about the conditions that they are working in because of fear of losing their jobs, right? And you see this in terms of all vulnerable workers, in terms of, you know, working class folks that can't, that really depend on work, right? Well, you know, that are particularly vulnerable in terms of depending on wage labor. And so definitely that is at play, right? And these systems in themselves are not really organized very well, but on top of that, these systematic, you know, structures of poverty and precarious immigration status and stuff like that definitely really increasingly make it so these systems really do not do much.
I'm wondering, could you talk a bit about maybe the types of injuries that we're seeing or specific cases or, you know, just the kind of work that these workers are exposed to?
Sure. Yeah. So as mentioned, like farm work is among one of the most dangerous industries. People are exposed to, are, you know, working with machinery that can expose, that basically plays a big risk. Like tractor rollovers are identified as as one of the highest incidents of injury and farm deaths. There's also a lot of people are working and are exposed to, you know, chemical inputs that come with agriculture, as well as exposures to intense, you know, heat from the sun and temperatures when they're working outside, to, you know, irritants such as pollens and different things like that. So it's just, as an industry itself and the type of work people are doing, it's just very it comes along with a lot of health issues that, that can accumulate. People are working, you know, repetitive, long, super long hours at quick paces sometimes, doing repetitive movements. So there's a lot of issues around that. Like, we hear a lot about people with, you know, muscle issues, musculoskeletal issues, because of the nature of the work. And so those, you know, we've connected to folks that, that a lot of their health issues that they have concerns are and are seeking kind of support around are really related to the experience of their work and the experience of the nature of farm work. And so that's kind of what we're seeing.
Could you walk us through like any specific cases or, you know, stuff that we might be aware of from the media or anything?
Sure. Yeah. Well, in terms of kind of connecting to International like Injured Worker Day, you know, there's been quite a lot of injuries that have been reported of folks working as migrant farm workers. And so a while back, I guess, a case where an individual was sprayed by pesticides and while he was working and basically developed kidney failure shortly after and basically had to then receive dialysis on a pretty frequent basis. And so he basically struggled for quite some time within the Canadian system trying to appeal his deportation, because basically he stopped being able to work and required dialysis. And as people are coming on very strict periods of time, usually no more under the SOP, no more than 8 months, and then their work permit expires and they're sent home. Once his work permit expired, he basically, people attended to, the system basically tried to kick him out. And so he struggled to kind of stay in Canada and appeal under a refugee claim and under humanitarian and compassionate claim to be able to stay, you know, saying that, you know, if he goes back to his home country, he cannot access dialysis services. So it would basically mean that he wouldn't have the dialysis and it would put his life in jeopardy. There's been other cases similarly of people getting injured. And basically because of their status and the way that they are here and the conditions and the system that regulates their stay and is able to deport them, they aren't really being able to get the support they need and address the injuries that they have endured here in this country. So that's a case that was a pretty severe case and it was in the news. There's a lot of cases that you don't hear about because, again, of the way the system works, that people are increasingly sent home and you see a lot of people getting injured and being sent home or getting sick and being sent home. And so this is, you know, there are cases where people do receive support here and you know, and some of their issues are addressed. They do connect to the compensation system here, but it definitely is not the majority of people.
What's the kind of awareness, I'm wondering, among migrant workers or in general about the compensation system?
So, yeah, it's very difficult. So, yeah, in terms of if when migrant farm workers are here, they have the right to workers' compensation like any other worker. So this would mean if they get injured or ill and it's identified as related to their work, they would get compensation and pay and things like that. And it would also trigger an investigation at the workplace to try to identify, you know, what happened and whether what happened was systemic and you know, and so. But in terms of folks actually being able to connect to the compensation system, like you were saying, it's not really working very well. The majority of people don't know that they have that right to compensation, or they don't know how to work the system. The system itself is, again, based on people coming forward or doctors also filing, you know, a claim, basically initiating the claim process. And saying that what they're seeing, you know, in their clinics or when somebody working as a migrant farm worker sees them, it's up to the doctor then to file it as work related, right? And so a lot of issues then are at play based on other, just the, you know, the broader issue of people not really accessing primary health services, right? So that's another issue that our group works at, even just to start getting services to be open at the times where folks are finishing work, and having them be able to have people who speak languages so that people can actually access those services. So that's not even something that's been even remotely resolved in a lot of these communities. So then to then depend on, you know, then the doctors, you know, following that, it's kind of in itself is a huge gap. And then, and yeah, there was a report by McLaughlin and Hennebree that was published in 2012 that asked a group of workers, I think it was around 100 workers or migrant farm workers, whether they were aware about the compensation system. And a large number, I think it was out of those 135%, said that they were not aware that they had that right. And I think something like 20-something percent said that they were aware, but they didn't have any idea of how to actually kind of mobilize or file a claim or just or connect to the system. And then in their report, they were really just talking about also folks feeling fearful about filing claims and kind of accessing that system, and what, you know, and their employer hearing that they're accessing the system in terms of premiums going up for employers and this investigations on workplace safety and stuff. So a lot of people just deciding not to. So a lot of people continuing to work with injuries, with occupational illnesses, hiding them or trying to work them out in the best way they can, or eventually, you know, going home or things like that. And what makes it really even more messed up, I guess, is that oftentimes, yeah, that people aren't connecting to these systems because of the easy, or them facing reprisals. And so they go back home and their conditions worsen. And oftentimes then they don't get let back into the program the next year. If they, you know, if their health deteriorates, they're just shut out of the program, out of this opportunity to continue making a livelihood through this program, when their condition or their injury was actually, you know, actually occurred as a result of working here. So it's kind of a pretty unjust kind of cycle of identifying a big problem.
Right. I mean, workers in Canada or domestic workers, ostensibly at least, won the right to some kind of comprehensive, like, compensation if they're injured on the job, because, like, obviously the theory behind it is that, you know, if you're deprived of your ability to make a living by your boss, then, well, you know, your boss has got to pay. And not only that, that's putting aside the kind of ethical arguments of when you're injured on the job. I'm wondering, we've focused mostly on injury and health and safety among migrant workers, but quickly, I was wondering, like, what are the other realities that migrant workers have to deal with in Ontario and across Canada
that aren't related to, like, health and safety and things like that? Or
yeah, I was thinking whether they're economic or just, I mean, the whole working in a continent that's not your own must be an experience in itself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, well, yeah, and everything kind of compounds itself, like the whole, I think, experience of that this program kind of puts people in definitely compounds to create a lot of hardships. I think that our group has been really focusing on, in terms of, like, on the ground work, has a lot of it has been focused on connecting people to health services, just because that has been a very big disconnect. A lot of people have been working here for quite some time and haven't seen, you know, access to doctor. In some of these communities, there's actually no services that are available to folks working as migrant farm workers. They either close too early or their family practices and they're not rostering new people. So in some communities we work in, basically the ER is the only point of access to any kind of health services. So that's a big issue that people face. Isolation, you know, racism, xenophobia. I think one of the biggest things and that kind of really structures the experience of folks too is just how easy and as mentioned, just how easy it is for them to be replaced and repatriated or deported. I think that really structures their ability to really mobilize around their concerns, voice their concerns. And, you know, recently this past December, since the beginning of the SOP in 1966, people coming under this program were paying into EI. So paying and paying and paying. And, you know, these sums that people were paying into employment insurance were huge. And they were not really, because again, their status, they were not really able to claim any of the benefits of that system, except for a couple benefits, including parental benefits, which was a bit of money if they had a baby back home. It was kind of like a baby bonus kind of check for them. And recently in December, the current government decided that they should not be given that benefit. So they canceled all future benefits around parental benefit, and people are still paying into that system. So that's kind of another example of kind of directed injustices against people working under these programs. And it's just basically they're just continuously excluded from really shaping the experience of migrating here under an organized program and things like that. They're just kind of completely excluded from voicing their concerns, from bettering, you know, the system, and keep kind of paying into it, keep supporting these industries, supporting the livelihoods of businesses here, and are kind of like left out and replaced as soon as they get injured or speak out or things like that. But another thing I was going to mention too, just based on what you were saying in terms of the compensation system, and that if, you know, the right to fight and or the gains made by whether if, you know, if you get hurt and you're unable to work, you know, the right to kind of get money and be supported. And in agriculture, I've been reading kind of this report, and I'm not finished reading it, but it's the agricultural fatalities in Canada between 1990 and 2008. And it kind of talks about, it's published by the Canadian Agricultural Injury Reporting. And it basically talks about accidents and fatalities within the industry. And it has on one page, it kind of has a line, and the organization's like, it's CAIR, but CAIR, which is again the Canadian Cultural Industry Injury Reporting. It says, you know, data shown in this report, data shows that agricultural injuries are not due to random isolated accidents. They are many recurring patterns of injury. And so I think that kind of is really important to really recognize in terms of some of the things that are happening, is that oftentimes we think of things as accidents and they kind of then just get banked as these fluke accidents, right? But in a lot of these industries that are, again, some of the most dangerous and unregulated industries, there are a lot of patterns and a lot of things that really need to be investigated and addressed. And a lot of production practices need to really be critically challenged because they continue to put people, you know, at risk and in situations where their health is very much jeopardized. And I think connecting to the situation of migrant workers is that as industries, as these labor shortages keep popping up in different industries, I think that should be kind of a red flag that something's up, you know, and we really need to kind of like understand these industries and kind of understand the conditions that are making some people not choose not to work in them. And then some people who are specifically and more intensely affected by poverty and by systems of oppression are taking these jobs, but then these industries aren't changing, or we're not bettering them. We're just continue to kind of be okay with people working these really dangerous jobs. And, you know, and it connects to discourses of, well, it's better than what they could, you know, find elsewhere and stuff like that. But I think we really need to challenge that.
So I'm wondering, like, what's the way forward? Do you know of like any demands that migrant workers or migrant worker organizations have? Or yeah, let's start with that. Like, what should we be asking for? What can we ask for? And how could we plug in if we wanted to, mm-hmm. or able to?
Yeah, I think, there's a lot, because there's so many obvious problems, I think, with both these programs and the regulation systems that kind of follow, that are put in place to supposedly help folks. But at different levels, I think right now, for example, the Toronto-based group, Justicia for Migrant Workers, has forwarded a human rights case to ask for an inquiry into the death of a migrant farm worker, Ned Perth, who basically was who died on a farm, on a tobacco farm, and was crushed on a tobacco farm. And basically, there has never been an inquiry into the death of a migrant farm worker. So Justicia has really amazingly been pushing this case forward and saying, you know, we need to investigate this case specifically to provide, you know, understanding, peace of mind to the family of this individual and in that form of justice, but also as an entrance to really look critically at this industry and really like look at the conditions that people are working in. So that's a campaign that I think is very important, because if that does go through, it will kind of set a precedent to really start critically looking at some of the conditions that are putting people at risk and basically people are dying. I think other stuff really has centered around, again, the ease of people being deported and repatriated. I think that is such a fundamental thing that needs to be challenged. If some sort of, you know, response to that or some sort of ability to really have folks not be deported or repatriated in these situations, that would just be change things a lot. I think people maybe would be able to speak their mind more, mobilize around their concerns. We'd hear a lot of more kind of coming forward of situations, and I think it would definitely change things up a lot. And I also think, for example, in Ontario, I think as you mentioned, farm workers aren't allowed to unionize, right? So, and we're seeing, for example, in provinces that you are allowed to unionize, you know, that would be a really great step to push for Ontario, and that it's been tried and it didn't work. But basically, still with the ability to repatriate people, that doesn't really work either in terms of a model of unionization. So I think the deportation thing is a big thing. So people often talk, migrant justice groups often talk about status on arrival as a really important piece of it, so that people to address the precarious immigration status, right? So that people can't be deported if it's status on arrival. So that's kind of something that people ask for too. Just anything really that addresses the risk of deportation and repatriation, I think would be something that's very important. And then in terms of the actual regulation system itself, I think having it from really basic things of language adequacy, you know, like translating and having these systems be available. You know, if you have an industry where there's, you know, 38,000 people arriving whose primary languages are not English and French, you'd think that then you'd have to adapt, you know, and that's not very difficult, and I don't think would take that many resources to literally translate a phone system or have some, you know, employ some people that can facilitate people connecting to that regulation system, and just basically not really connecting or depending on people to come forward, but have it be more of a proactive system and actually starting to do that. And obviously there's a lot of politics involved in government and industry being tied together and things like that. So, but I think that would be something that really needs to change also.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking. I'm wondering, do you want to give any Forza Porza contact information if people want to get involved?
Sure, yeah. And we're doing a variety of activities and work this summer, so if people want to get connected, we're in the middle of helping to organize some health fairs in different regions. So these happen every summer where we invite we collaborate with local health service providers and community members in different regions to plan this event where service providers and social support organizations come together and offer information about their services and services themselves on particular days for folks coming as migrant farm workers. So we have those activities. We also have a campaign still trying to mobilize around the EI issue and trying to challenge that and show how unjust that is. So we have a few things going on. And in Guelph, we're also working around community responses to deportation, as that increasingly becomes an issue with the changes to the refugee system. So if folks want to connect and work with us, our email is Fuerza, which is FUERZA.Puerza, which is PUWERSA @gmail.com. And also we can connect, depending on where folks are, we can also connect folks to other immigrant justice groups that are working in different cities as well. So,
Awesome. Thanks again for coming in, and hopefully next time we'll have some happy victories to talk about and not just depressing stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And there is definitely a lot of great stuff going on. And yeah.
Okay. Thank you.